From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We are joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccan. Most importantly, you are you. You are here. And that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. Now, we're recording at a slightly different time today. I want to check in with you guys. How are you doing? How was your weekend?
Well, Matt has been off on adventures, as you would say, Ben, and I think we have both missed him very much. Matt, how was your weekend? I know you were playing with some fun new toys.
Yeah, I just got these new binaural mics. I was running around my house recording some things and yelling and pretending to be a zombie in the exterior or on the exterior of my house. So I'm sure my neighbors think I'm insane, but that's great.
Was there grunting involved? Was there like,
oh yes, lots of zombie sounds.
That sounds fun, dude. Well, I'm glad you occupied yourself productively during your time off.
I did. Good times. Missed you guys. Thanks for you know, holding down the fort while I was away.
Well, we saved this episode for you specifically, Matt. This is this topic came to us from an anonymous source. We always talk about our call-in line, the various ways you can contact us. So someone called 1-833-STDWYTK recently and left a message that sent us down a bit of a rabbit hole.
Yeah, so this person called in after we did, I believe it was Chemtrails in the UK. We did that episode, and this person wrote in to tell us about the topic we're going to be covering today. Just mentioned it to us, hey, we should look into it, and what we found was surprising.
Yeah. Yeah, you see, regardless of where you live nowadays, regardless of where you reside in the globe of ours, your local news is probably full of crises. They're both real and imagined. And they're all terrible things, right? That's how news makes money. Some of these disasters, like the war on Christmas, are more or less, you know, seasonal hoaxes. Everybody's hip to it. They're meant to rile people up, to make them behave a certain way. Others, like COVID-19, are unfortunately all too real. Today, we are exploring something that was once upon a time considered a conspiracy theory all its own, and that is global warming. Over the past few decades, numerous government institutions, thousands of private entities have been aware of the massive threat posed by global warming. And the gist of global warming is this. Even tiny changes in our average temperatures on Earth's surface or in its atmosphere can have long-reaching, devastating effects on the world overall. When we say small amounts, we mean like 5 degrees. That is how fragile our existence is. That's the small kind of variable that our entire ecosystem depends on. 5 degrees up, 8 degrees up, things are wild at that point. And most people, here's the thing, nowadays, most people agree this is a problem. Everyone's aware of it. It should come as no surprise, however, that no one has proposed a solution that everyone supports. So what's going on? I know I've probably already made a couple of people angry in the audience today by saying that global warming is not, in fact, a conspiracy. But let's look at it. What is global warming? What is climate change? Here are the facts.
Well, I mean, you know, climate change is certainly something that you can observe. We can definitely see our climate changing year over year. It gets hotter, quicker. And it's just kind of something that you can very much experience with your senses. So I don't understand why it's controversial. But yeah, let's talk about weather versus climate, for example. Weather refers to localized atmospheric conditions occurring over short periods of time, anywhere from a couple of days to just a few minutes. So things like rain and snow, cloud cover, storms, floods, these are examples of weather events. They happen and then they're gone over a short period of time. Climate is just a pullback view of all of that. It refers to a series of these kinds of events, patterns that happen over a longer period of time, long-term regional or even global averages of temperature, humidity, rainfall patterns. These things are seasonal. They happen over seasons, years, or even decades.
So an easy way to think about it is if you look outside or you listen in and there's a thunderstorm going on, that is your friendly neighborhood weather. And that's just how it's going to be. You see an oddly rain-free weekend in a time when you usually see rain. That's also going to be weather. But let's say you're dealing with a year-long drought, or let's say that the amount of rain that's happening every year is decreasing year over year for, you know, let's say a decade or two. That's going to be climate. And that thing is changing.
Yep. This is the issue. I think it escapes a lot of people, even people who should know better. Climate change is the long-term change in the average weather patterns and the big patterns, the things that define Earth on a local, regional, and global climactic scale. Global warming is just that, it's like a subdivision of it. It's long-term heating of Earth's climate system. And we've observed this since the pre-industrial period. That would be about, the 1850s to the early 20th century. We've observed it due to human activities, mainly fossil fuel burning, because fossil fuel burning increases the amount of carbon dioxide, nitrous oxide, methane, ozone, so on, the so-called greenhouse gases. And they're called greenhouse gases because they trap heat from the sun in Earth's atmosphere. It's like the old Roach Motel advertisements. You know what I mean? The sun's energy checks in, but it can't check out. And this is bad for us, because we have evolved to live in an environment where there is not as much greenhouse gas. So when you think about climate change and when you think about global warming, it's kind of like how all mazes are puzzles, but not all puzzles are mazes, like how all quesadillas are snacks, but not all snacks are quesadillas, how all anime is animated, but not all animation is, you get it. You get the moving picture here.
Ben, I take issue with quesadilla being a snack. That is an entree, my friend. That is an entree.
I don't know, man. I don't know. I'm working life. But agree to disagree then. So fair. So I can eat like 2-3 quesadillas as a setting. I may have a problem. But but quesadillas aside, one of the most important differences between climate change and global warming is that climate change can occur naturally. And people don't mention this enough. It gets wrapped up in all these weird conspiracy theories. We have to remember that ice ages came and went way before humans started humaning or whatever. The thing is that most, but probably not all, changes in Earth's climate since the early 1900s that we can measure, they have been driven by human activity. But there were still natural things. They're a very important part of the story.
Well, isn't it also a matter, Ben, of, those ice ages that came and went naturally? That was a much longer timeline than we're talking about, too. When the human intervention comes into the picture, we start to see these things happen a little more rapidly in, like, our lifetime, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we have to remember, of course, that we are very much not super important. Humans are very much not super important to life on Earth as anything more than a threat. Billions and billions of years passed. Ice ages came and went. Volcanoes erupted, which that's super cool. There were earthquakes, there were floods, there were tectonic shifts. The continents were in different positions. And then we showed up basically very recently, at the very end.
Walking in like we own the place. But yeah, those natural changes are things like El Nino, La Nina, and so on, or changes in the sun's output, Earth's orbit, or one of the coolest, most metal examples, which would be giant volcanic eruptions. Yeah, those are great. But those do a real number on the atmosphere. They actually naturally do some of the things that we're talking about today. Humans don't have any control over this stuff, but we, like all living things on Earth, hope for the best and also kind of have a little bit of a God complex where we want to figure out how to do these kinds of things.
Yeah, and you know, when you get into some of the climate change debates, one of the major arguments you're going to see for climate change being a hoax is what we just mentioned here, changes in the sun and how much energy is actually being emitted from the sun and at what time and what kinds of cycles the sun goes through compared to the cycles that the Earth is going on, and then how those two things interact and whether or not global climate change is actually just the sun changing. That's a debate for a different day. For this episode, we're going to take it in, or we're going to take it as though that is not the primary thing that is affecting the Earth and how the atmosphere is being affected and how the climate is actually changing.
Anthropocene, baby.
Yeah, yes, exactly. So we're going to talk about, or we are thinking about man-made things here. Again, fossil fuels, a lot of the methane that gets up into the atmosphere and other gases that get up in the atmosphere because of factory farming and things like that. But, you know, as always, that old black gold, you know, the Texas tea, that's going to be one of the main things. Just burning off these things traps that heat because of the CO2 and the other things that are being released.
And this is also, I don't think it's in the notes, but this is coming, this is important. A lot of developing countries have a problem with industrial countries, or the so-called quote-unquote first world countries, telling them to practice pollution controls, because the idea is like, oh, okay, you're making us run this race with a backpack of bricks because you already burned all the coal you needed. You know what I mean? Hydroelectric energy and solar energy is all well and good for you guys, but we shouldn't have to, like, you couldn't have gotten where you are, you know, Western Europe, United Kingdom, US, et cetera, if you hadn't been able to just throw all this garbage into the sky for, you know, a century or more.
Did you guys ever play the game Age of Empires?
Yes.
Was that sort of like a Sim City, but like with like civilizations kind of, or no?
It was more of a war strategy game.
Got it.
Essentially, but it was also civilization building. But one of the primary things you had to do in that game, and I think it is very telling here, it's exactly what civilizations have to do, what countries have to do. You have to build up, you have to level up essentially your technology. And one of the primary steps you have to get to is essentially fossil fuel burning, the industrial age, where you have to make enough power to do all the things that you need to do to advance further. And yeah, that's exactly what you're saying there, Ben. It's just, if you remove that step by making countries and governments control exactly how much emissions they're allowed to put out there, then you're really just, you're going to handicap them.
Yeah. It's like the same people who built their fortunes on these sorts of acts, right? This kind of energy are the same institutions that are telling other up-and-comers that they cannot play by the same rules. And the, you know, is it hypocritical? Sure, yes. But also our understanding as a species of the problem has changed. We know a lot more about what's going on. We just learned it a little too late. My nihilism is probably going to come to the forefront here because there are some consequences, right? We know very well the consequences. Science obeys no political party. Science obeys no religious ideology. Science could not care less about what part of the world you live in, what you like for breakfast, etc. There are genuine consequences of human-created global warming. As far as we can tell, they are biblical level, like Book of Revelations things. Like, first off, weather. I love the way you guys describe weather is a function of climate, right? So if the climate is changing, the weather is changing. And because this is the real world, those changes are not like super awesome. They're not convenient or whatever. A warmer climate creates this atmosphere that collects, retains, and drops more water but in different places. So wet areas are becoming wetter than they should be across, you know, the year, monsoon season or so on. And dry areas are becoming drier than they should be. Floods in Bangladesh, pretty soon, like within your lifetime, there are going to be parts of the world that are uninhabitable because of record-breaking heat in the Middle East, for instance, or in Africa. There's just not enough AC for everybody. And some world governments seem to be pretending there is, but they have to know better. Weather and climate affect agriculture. Food supplies. Oof. Everybody thought it was crazy for those MREs, but they last forever. Buy some.
Yeah, there's this concept of climate refugees, this notion that the part of the world where you find yourself in could potentially become unlivable. Basically, the closer to the equator that you get, the higher the likelihood that your descendants or potentially even you might have to move. Your kids could become climate refugees as well as yourself, as this stuff, you know, can kind of escalate. And as we talked about, the timeline moves pretty quickly when human intervention becomes involved. Sea levels will continue to rise as ice caps melt. So say goodbye to some of your favorite vacation spots like the Maldives or what have you. And then there's, you know, the issue of wildlife not being able to adapt. We know wildlife can adapt. We know that, you know, evolution does occur for changing conditions, but that requires a very long timeline. So wildlife can't adapt quickly enough, and it can cause extinction events. The human species will, for all intents and purposes, descend into a different kind of war, which is the war for resources.
Mm-hmm. A different kind of war, Noel. They're all resource wars. No, I'm just joking.
No.
Not all of them, but most of them.
Yeah, I agree. I thought you would pick up on that point, especially, Matt, because we had talked for years about, what was it? The Third World War will be about water. That still feels true.
Whether it's rising sea levels or just not having enough potable water, it's...
I mean, guys, we're in one right now, or at least, you know, things are sort of leveling out, but there was a few weeks or months even where you couldn't get toilet paper, you know, and people were losing their minds about it. I mean, that's just like sort of an inkling of how bad things could get, right?
Oh, I did some research off the books on that, and I think I have an explanation for it, which is pretty interesting, and also I'm 80% sure it's true. It might be for another day, but I think I figured out at least the toilet paper, and it's not because there wasn't enough. It's bizarre, but yeah, we've painted these problems, right? First off, to your point, whether it's toilet paper or water, the entire human species is just so ready to buck at each other at any given point about any given thing. It doesn't even matter, right? People of the same religion wage religious wars on each other because they disagree with the interpretation of one sentence, of one chapter, of an unimportant part of their favorite book. You know what I mean? And maybe I've offended people by saying some parts of your favorite book might not be as important as others. But the point is, this is very bad. Human beings are in a bad situation. We're driving headlong over a cliff, an existential cliff, and the rest of the living things on Earth are sort of in the backseat of the car with us saying, where are we going? What are we doing? It's up to human beings to find the solution to this problem we have created. What are the solutions? We'll tell you after a word from our sponsor. And we're back. So, yes, in addition to creating tons of problems for every living thing on Earth, our human species has also created a couple of solutions. You know, we've been in our writer's room, we got our whiteboard, we've been brainstorming. But first, and this is very important, don't let the various misleading discourses fool you. Don't let the people in mainstream news or the weird, like, Koch brothers funded documentaries, don't let any of that fool you. The experts throughout the planet we're pretty much universally on the same page about global warming and have been for decades. And when I say experts, I do mean governments, you know, I do mean academics. I also mean oil companies like Exxon. Exxon knew about this. They knew global warming was real and that people were doing it way back in 1977, more than a decade before anybody else publicly cared about it.
And they didn't tell anybody, Ben? They just kept this to themselves? To what end? Why wouldn't they tell everybody? Why wouldn't they just come screaming this, you know, to the high heavens, Ben?
Well, they were definitely screaming something to the public.
Was it money? What were they screaming, Ben?
Yeah, well, they spent some money on the studies. The studies were pretty conclusive. The internal memos confirmed that the executives talked about this and how real it was. And then they spent millions over the next few decades trying to fight any legislation because, you see, fighting global warming would affect the bottom line of a fossil fuel company.
Yeah, that's right. And we actually interviewed Amy Westervelt, who makes a podcast called Drilled. We did that last year in 2019, and we went over in great detail what these companies knew, when they learned it. And if you want to check that episode out, please go do it now. But one of the major things to remember here, Ben, one of the videos we were watching in research for this was a Stanford University professor, David Keith, and he was speaking about the 1964 academic papers that were coming out where they're discussing, hey, guys, there seems to be an issue here, just raising their hands, you know, and just saying, hey, maybe we should start thinking about ways we can prevent the Earth from warming up too much, because it looks like we might be having an effect. So, yeah, it's still a jump from 64 to 77 or so, but 77 is pretty early to be aware of this.
Everybody knew it was a real conspiracy. It was not a conspiracy theory. It's just like those senators who were doing insider trading and dumping all their stocks while they were telling people not to worry about the quote unquote so-called pandemic, right? The oil companies were doing the same thing. The point is, we could have had a much, much earlier head start. Proposed solutions for global warming include things like a carbon tax. This is something that people who read The Economist, for instance, would really enjoy. The gist is that, you know, we make countries or companies pay a premium somehow for their carbon emissions or fossil fuels. Now, you can see, of course, how the developing world would say this is massively unfair. This is, you know, victimizing the impoverished geopolitically, because it is in terms of development. It's not a perfect solution. And also, companies and entities that are at the top, the ones that rule the rest, don't tend to pay taxes anyway. Not really.
Yeah. Well, the other major issue here is that other actions have to be taken rather than just, you know, monetary incentivizing and paying, like having to pay more money if you're going to essentially put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, because now it's inevitable that warming is going to happen, and it has been for quite a while now. We have to find ways to actually cool it down or prevent the warming or get stuff out of the atmosphere. We have to go to more drastic measures now, and they are not easy.
Yeah, we've been incentivizing alternative energy, right? And one thing that's interesting, the world is recovering right now because people are flying less, they're traveling less, we're producing fewer things. This is actually a record-breaking year for alternative energy in a couple of places in Western Europe. Like, there are a couple of countries that have gone completely free from coal or have drastically reduced their usage of it. But to your point, Matt, even taxing people for fossil fuels, even you know, making it cheaper for them to use solar, geothermal, hydroelectric energy, that's still not enough. And so the question is, what if we tried something else? Because there's another answer here. Just maybe. Remember those epic, giant volcanic eruptions? What if we could just sort of, you know, do that? Here's where it gets crazy.
Yeah. Well, the reason why we would want to do that is because it actually has a cooling effect, a measurable cooling effect, anytime a giant volcano explodes. So the mimicking that we're talking about here, it's a thing, it's real, it's a proposed solution or part of a proposed solution to global climate change, and it's called stratospheric aerosol injection. Oh boy. It's certainly, well, let's say at this point it is a theoretical solution, but it is a geoengineering technique that could possibly happen in the near future and a way to combat man-made temperature rise on planet Earth.
Right. Like, geoengineering is sort of a blanket term for things like that could include everything from cloud seeding, this notion of, you know, changing the weather through science. And this is just, you know, one of numerous techniques and technologies, some more theoretical than others. But this one does seem to be, you know, something that could absolutely be implemented. And so geoengineering in terms of, like, you know, cooling the Earth's temperatures, there's two kind of big paths that you could go down. The first would be this concept of sucking up all of the kind of scattered CO2 particles and greenhouse gases that are already in the atmosphere, sort of hoovering them up. And then the second would be solar radiation management, i.e., affecting the way the sun's rays interact with the atmosphere. And that is absolutely where SAI comes in.
And SAI stands for stratospheric aerosol injection. Not the, you know, catchiest of terms. It sounds a little technical, and it should, because it is. But it's pretty wild, okay? Are we talking about impersonating volcanoes? Yes, kind of. But walk with us here. You know, let us finish the pitch. What if we took a ton of balloons, right? Or airships or drones or planes or, you know what, missiles. Why not? Artillery. And we just sent them up into the stratosphere to release sulfates into the air. To the point about cloud seeding, this is something. This is similar to the stuff that the government of China and the government of the United States, as well as the government of the United Kingdom, have all done in the past. With cloud seeding, you disperse, I believe it's silver iodide, and the idea is that it will attract moisture droplets so you can form clouds. Cloud seeding is all about forming clouds. Orgone energy is all about busting clouds. You can check out both of those episodes for more information. But we would be doing this on a much larger scale.
And a much higher scale.
Yeah, literally. To what you were saying earlier, Matt, volcanoes do this naturally. When they erupt, they shoot tons of aerosol particles into the air, and they create something that is known as global dimming. The particles released by volcanoes, if the volcano is large enough, for a time, they run a sort of scrimmage line, a filter between the Earth's surface and the sun. They reduce the amount of light and heat that enters the atmosphere. So you can see the logic start to form here, right?
And SAI is going to try and mimic this by delivering sulfide gases, the same kind of stuff, sulfur dioxide, hydrogen sulfide, sulfuric acid, way up. We're talking around 60,000 feet into the air. It's the mesosphere and stratosphere, and we're going to talk about this, but there's no real good way to do that at 60,000 feet right now. We'll get into that. But the research shows that if we could do this effectively and enough, this would, or could at least, counter changes to temperature, as well as temperatures in the oceans, change the water temperature back to a place where animals could live, you know? Instead of just die with the ocean acidification and all the other things that are happening. And here's the other thing, too. it's not like this would be a crazy slow process. You shoot all this stuff up into the stratosphere and then you got to wait and wait and wait. No, it would happen pretty quickly if we did it right.
So you're saying we should pump sulfuric acid up into the sky? Is that what I'm getting here?
Yeah,
not you, like the you. I mean the you of science or whoever's saying this. That sounds like there could be some issues.
We're gonna blot out the sun, Noel.
So why haven't we done it, right? That's the question. Why haven't we? You know, I don't know about you guys. I'm sold. Why haven't we just shot a ton of sulfur dioxide, SO2, hydrogen sulfide, sulfuric acid into the sky? I mean, God knows we're putting out plenty of pollution as it is. What's a little more? Let's answer that question, because spoiler alert, it turns out there are some issues with stratospheric aerosol injection, and we'll explore them after a word from our sponsors. All right, we know what you're thinking, right? First off, what's the bottom line, right? You're saying, Matt, Mission Control, Noel, Ben, let's talk turkey. Obviously, this isn't happening because it's crazy expensive. Well, we have some weird news for you.
Yeah, strangely enough, it's not that expensive because, you know, we kind of mentioned this earlier in the show. It's pretty low tech, ultimately. I mean, you know, it involves planes or drones or balloons or airships or what have you. But it's stuff that we already have. And we could even use artillery. We could actually fire these chemicals up into the atmosphere. The chemicals are super easy to obtain. So that's not really an issue at all. I think I saw some. I mean, it's, you know, it's not like this has been like, you know, spreadsheeted out exactly yet, but I saw somewhere it would be only be in the handful of billions of dollars, not like the trillions. You know, it would definitely be costly in terms of, like, you know, you or I money, but in terms of government big brother money, it's kind of a drop in the bucket.
Well, okay, maybe my understanding is off here. The way I've been thinking about this from some of the writing was that it would take years right now, as of right now, it would take years to engineer a plane that would be needed to make these, like, to chemtrail style seed this stuff out there into the atmosphere, because of the altitude that the planes would have to, or the jets would have to operate at. And because my understanding is around 60,000 feet is where you need to put the stuff, all these chemicals, and then you would have to make constant runs, basically.
Oh, like, yeah.
You would have a fleet of enough planes that are just going up there. I don't know the exact frequency, but let's say, just for sake of argument, every day. And they would also have to carry enough of a payload at 60,000 feet to actually make it worth the trip.
Well, and I don't mean to imply that it would be like, yes, we're ready to roll with this yesterday. But I mean, the basis of the technology exists. It would obviously require some retrofitting to, you know, you'd end up with some kind of hybrid vehicle somewhere between a regular plane and like a spacecraft, because it would need to have some of those protections to be able to go to that altitude. But the chemicals are available, the technology, the basis of it, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. We just kind of have to improve it a little bit to make it happen.
One thing that I think is, this is something where I'd love to hear from you, fellow conspiracy realists. The science here is looking pretty sound, but we as a global community, we as a species are still kind of in the brainstorming phase. So if you have an idea about how this would, about how best to deliver this, if you're in favor of it, which not everybody is, then let us know. You know, hit us up, conspiracy@iheartradio.com, or any of the various ways you want to find us. You know, our Facebook page will probably blow up with some weird threads about this. Yeah, you know, you're both right here. It's not super expensive. The technology exists. It needs tweaking because, for instance, you know, one of the first things I thought about was, what about recoverable ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles? Some of those can go, could function high enough, but they don't have, at least that I'm aware, they don't have the seeding kind of apparatus, right? They can't really be the crop dusters for the stratosphere that we need. So it's like, we do have all the technology, but we don't have it all in the one thing we need, right? We have some stuff that can do task A. We have some stuff that can do task B. We need something that can just do the alphabet of the task in a one-stop shop. And yeah, to your point, Noel, we can make or obtain the chemicals. This is so weird. It reminds me of the Mr. Show sketch about blowing up the moon because they figured out they could do it. And
yeah,
and we figured out we could do it. But here's the problem. So if we know that theoretically we're really close to being able to do this, the technology is there. We just need to get the perfect remix. We have to ask ourselves, how efficient will it be? What will the efficacy be? Will this actually work? And this is a big sticking point. It's something we talked a little bit about in the course of today's episode. Those chemicals, SO2 and all its the rest of its entourage, they're short-lived. And that's a good thing for the bulk of human history, because that's the reason that a volcanic eruption, even a massive one, doesn't put us out of the game forever. That's the reason why we're not living in some horrible, a different kind of horrible situation. The aerosol chemicals there can only be where we really need them to be for a couple of weeks, maybe 1 or 2 months, and we would have to be, and that's if we're 100% certain that the particles are the right size. That makes a huge difference. And that's also why we would have to institute a program. So like that number 18 billion is kind of a watermark we hear as a get started. Right. It's a get started number. I just want to say for the record, Jeff Bezos, if you're listening, I see that now as of May 18th, 2020, your net worth is over an estimated $140 billion. And if we call this kind of earth saving Bond villain working for good project $20 billion, then that means you, Jeff, alone can do this 7 times. You can attempt to save the world in this way 7 times.
But here's the thing, among many things and sticky parts of this whole concept. I mean, it would require like global consensus, right? Like, I mean, it would do it in a way that benefited everyone in like a single unilateral kind of like, you know, implementation of this. It would require the kind of UN level cooperation that we don't really typically see. And also, again, this is very new. I mean, not super new, but like new in the scale of civilization, new technology and this concept. So I've read, there's a lot of, you know, varying opinions about this. And one thing that I've read is that it wouldn't be a one size fits all for all regions. Like there would be potentially regions that would not benefit from this and that could be actually harmed by this and could harm agriculture in certain regions. And this thing could like, you know, benefit, certain areas of the country. And then there are other areas that it could actually harm in terms of like their normal, you know, levels of agricultural output, that it could really, you know, have a negative effect on that. Have you guys seen anything about these issues?
Yeah, for sure. And the American Meteorological Society put out a statement in 2013. Yes, 2013, where they talked about some of these issues. And, you know, similarly to other major hard problems that are out there, they basically were saying, hey, we need more research on all of this stuff, the potential for everything. We need to study historical, ethical, legal, and social implications that this geoengineering could have across the planet in different places. And we need to develop and analyze policy options. So basically, it's the same thing that we've seen time and time again for decades now when it comes to hard problems like climate change. And it's everybody doesn't want to deal with it while they're in office. That's what it feels like to me. I mean, the Meteorological Society is correct that we need way more research. We need way more information on this before we act. But if we don't act soon in some major way, what do we do? It's already too late. It's just, it's a tough thing. Just last thing here is David Keith. I got it wrong. I think I said he was with Stanford. He spoke at Stanford. He's from the University of Calgary. That's my bad. Sorry about that, Professor Keith.
Yeah, he's got a great lecture on this. It runs a little more than an hour, but if you're interested in it, he goes through the different angles. He's really spent some time on the cognitive road with this one. I do want to mention too that, like many macro level changes, global proposed changes. First off, yes, obviously, as you know, longtime listeners, human beings cannot agree on anything, and the greater good is a very dangerous, subjective kind of Rorschach ink blot. And so we know that humans probably won't cooperate. I think to your point, Matt, it's especially instructive to look back over, the weakness of democracy. And now I'm not arguing for authoritarianism or fascism or whatever, but I will point out that we've seen time and time again, people who are elected for 2, 4, or 6 years tend to focus on things that will show results within 2, 4 to 6 years. You're not going to, if you're a president asking someone to sacrifice literally anything about their life because it'll be better in 25 years, you're probably not going to get reelected. And it really doesn't matter what you believe, how right or wrong you are. People are like, hey, buddy, I elected you for 2, 4 to 6 years, and that is the metric upon which you are being graded. We're just, as humans, we just suck at this kind of stuff. So I don't even think it's corporations necessarily being insidious. It's the tragedy of the commons, right? We're very, very bad at allowing other people to exist, whether they're people who are alive at the same time as us, or whether they're people who inherit the earth we leave behind. And that's like, that goes across the board. I'm sorry. There's not a person alive who doesn't have a problem with that. Is the solution then some kind of world government, some kind of AI that says, hey, look, we know that this is going to hurt people in parts of the world. Specifically, we know this is going to hurt some very disadvantaged people who don't have the infrastructure or the technology to deal with the famine that we would be creating. We would be creating this. We know that volcanic eruptions have been linked to famine in the 1990s because of that global dimming. The crops don't grow. And this is just going to exacerbate the horrific living conditions for some people who are already living in dire straits right now without any SAI. And volcanic eruptions, leading to famine are just one example of the deleterious side effects that would occur. The thing about this is we're essentially shooting stuff into the atmosphere, and that stuff, even if it's very tiny, is still at the whims of gravity. That means that these particles, depending on how they are distributed or dispersed, could return to Earth's surface. And if they do, they can worsen existing medical conditions. If you have asthma, you want to stay away from these chemicals. But imagine if they just start raining down on you. And then, it's all about placement. It could be good for us for a little while if we get the right size particles in the right place. But if we put them in the wrong place, like if we put them in a stratospheric clouds at Earth's poles, they could damage the ozone layer, which has been having a hard time lately in general.
And not to mention that it could potentially reduce global rainfall around the world, especially in the summer when you've got these monsoon seasons. And there's some pretty solid scientific evidence that links volcanic eruption to famine in Ethiopia in the 90s. So maybe not the best move to, you know, approximate the effects of tons of volcanic explosions, because who knows what the side effects could be. It really does feel like, you know, the way things are kind of fast-tracked through like FDA approval, and then all of a sudden we realize what the side effects are once it's actually out there in the world, and it's kind of hard to put those badgers back in those bags. So I don't know. It's I always am concerned with, let's just give it a try. Let's just shoot it up there and see what happens. You know, I feel like there definitely needs to be more research.
What we need is a giant vacuum that just sucks all the CO2 up, or it needs to be an ionized pole of some sorts that is attached to a plane,
you know,
that
like
goes 60,000 feet and just gets all the CO2.
You know, like a shop vac. Whoop. Never mind. Suck it. Remember from The Office? Never mind.
I do remember.
Okay, good. And, you know, you can't deny that this SAI or any of this geoengineering stuff is really just a Band-Aid and is just kind of a quick fix so that we don't have to think on a longer timeline, which, you know, governments and corporate, well, governments specifically, Ben, to your point, have proven pretty incapable of doing. I mean, even the current situation we find ourselves in with COVID-19, we see the government just kind of like wringing their hands and pulling their hair out with even attempting to think about things more than 2 weeks out in the future. I mean, it just seems, you know, absolutely mind-boggling to think about something on as long a timeline as climate change requires. And it's why you start getting, you know, this rhetoric around the idea that it's not real, that it's some kind of hoax, and it really is just kind of an excuse to not do anything about it. And that is exactly what this technology would be, is an excuse to not do anything about it.
I like that phrase. Yeah, it's a new space age way of kicking the can down the road, huh? So it's interesting too, because what we're telling you is that despite all of the people who have, you know, poo-pooed the idea of chemtrails or said, you know, I am a skeptic, chemtrails do not exist, this is our, what, second episode in a few months proving that things like chemtrails are very much on the, in the front of the mind of the certain areas of the scientific community. This is a chemtrail proposal, essentially. And, you know, Matt, I cannot read your mind, because we are recording virtually here, but I was thinking of you during the research for this, and I have to ask you, does this not sound just a little bit like what humans did in the AI battle that like precedes the events of the Matrix? They blot out the sun?
Yes, it sounds exactly like that, in fact. In that movie, they blot out the sun because all the machines use solar energy, right? That's the whole concept there. And in our case, we're just trying to blot out the sun to make it a little less hot, just a little bit.
Yeah, but when they do that in the Matrix, don't the machines adapt and figure out how to like harvest energy from like human spines and brains?
Yes. We become the batteries.
Isn't it just like a Band-Aid that creates a much, much worse situation, not to put too fine a point on it?
Now, as large as an impact as that movie had on me, it is just a movie, guys. But it feels like maybe a bad call, because it made most of the surface of the Earth uninhabitable to humans. Because it got out of hand, essentially, I'm imagining. Or, well, no. In that movie, it was an extreme case, right, where they actually wanted to do all the giant volcano explosions to blot out the sun. In our case, we're trying to do a moderate number of giant volcanic explosions controlled over time through aerosol injection. So really, guys, there's nothing to worry about. We're fine. We should just do it.
Why not? You know what I mean? Yippee-ki-yay, right? Let's hop on the bomb and Dr. Strangelove it down into fame.
Guys, if I may just do a little sarcasm alert here. Sarcasm alert. Please do not read the things Ben and Matt just said as them speaking their hearts. That is all.
Correct. But there's also, well, to an extent at least, but there's also like, you know, there seems like there could be something here. We just don't know enough yet. I would say it, in my gut says it feels like a bad idea, but we have to do something. And maybe this is one way to at least attempt to tackle the problem.
Maybe it gives us a little more time to figure out an actual solution.
Yeah.
If it, I mean, that's why we use the phrase Band-Aid so often, right? The idea is that, you know, if all things go well, which they never do, we will be able to fix something. We'll be able to find a permanent solution, or at least give our species and life on Earth here a chance to move beyond this planet into the stars, which is, or different dimensions, etc. But moving into the stars is ultimately the goal of life on Earth, right? That's what we've been kind of working for. That's our big next season if we survive. One note on this, experts believe that if we do practice stratospheric aerosol injections, it will affect the color of the sky. It won't darken it the way that the humans in the Matrix did. It will actually lead to something called sky whitening. Sunsets will be more colorful. It'll be the kind of change that you can walk outside and notice. So one of the questions I think a lot of people are wondering is this already happening? Good news, maybe not yet. We would probably know whether this is the case if it was, because there would be visible changes. It would have to the point we've made a couple times today, it would have to be an all-at-once situation. It would have to be global, right? Like you could do cloud seeding the way that Uncle Sam did in Southeast Asia, and you could create regional floods. But if you tried to practice SAI in one region of the world, it probably wouldn't do much. And if it did something, it wouldn't be very helpful, right? So that's the even bigger question. Should we do this?
Well, I would propose to you this, Ben, because of the amount of scientific research that's been going into this, the number of articles, scholarly articles you can find on this subject, there are several, because there are several startups, like tech startups that are trying to come up with a way for this to be able to happen, at least starting from the United States and then moving outward. It feels like maybe there are some tests going on or some tech being developed in the background, like for those planes, for instance, that we were talking about, the ones that have to go to very high altitude. I would suspect that there's testing going on now, but that the actual full-on spraying is not happening for sure.
So what do you think? Should this happen at a full scale, knowing that we will, you know, if Earth somehow agrees to do this, if we make this a priority, we say, okay, the almost 8 billion of us are going to collectively impersonate volcanoes. We're going to do it, you know, like every couple of months, just to give us some more time to not destroy ourselves. But we know that we are going to be killing many people along the way. We're just not going to be killing everybody. Is that the right thing to do? Is Spock right when he says the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few? Is this a true case of greater good? And if that's not the solution, then what is? We want to hear from you. You can find us. We're all over the internet.
In most places, we are Conspiracy Stuff, sometimes Conspiracy Stuff Show. I believe that's Instagram. You can, contact us on all those places. Tell us what you think. You can check out Here's Where It Gets Crazy. It's our Facebook community page. Check that out. You can, you know, talk with other fellow conspiracy realists about this episode and others and make suggestions. You can also give us a call.
You can absolutely give us a call. We are 1-833-STDWYTK. That is basically a direct line to Matt Frederick's personal cell phone device, where he's awaiting your call.
That's right. I sit here patiently waiting for you to ring.
Patiently. No, it's not. It actually goes to all of us. But Matt has been just an absolute champion of this line and has been known to give people a ring back occasionally. So I pitch this as a feature. I know Matt might pitch it as a bug, but I think it's a positive thing. If you give Matt, if you give us a call, you might just get a follow-up from our boy Matt Frederick.
Is that a cane, Ben Bolin? What is that that I'm looking at? Umbrella.
I'm so glad you asked, Matt. It's actually my trusty, I don't know if you can see it, it's my trusty cane sword.
Oh,
nice.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, I can't take it to the airport, but it's fun. It's fun to walk around with. And if you are a fan of segues to an email address, boy, do I have some news for you. You can contact us 24/7, any old time of day or night, even if the sky changes color on you. We are
conspiracy@iheartradio.com. Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.